Hello, I'm Jason Steinle, and you're about to listen to an Upload Experience audio program, where you can upload a lifetime of experience in a single moment. Be sure to check us out online at www.uploadexperience.com/blog, and you can download past shows by visiting iTunes and searching Upload Experience in the podcast. There you'll find a variety of feeds. And do us a favor, if you like our show, if you like our conversations, be sure to leave us a comment on iTunes and sign up for our newsletter. You'll receive periodic updates about guests, be notified with new shows coming out, and receive information to help make your life easier. Thanks for stopping by. I hope you enjoyed today's program. I'll talk to you soon. Goodbye now. Welcome to The Steinle Show. I'm your host, Jason Steinle. Joining us on the show today is Missy Vineyard. Missy is a practitioner and teacher of the Alexander Technique. In fact, she founded the Alexander Technique School, New England, and she is the author of the book, How You Stand, How You Move, How You Live. So Missy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
What exactly is the Alexander Technique?
There's the question. I'd like to keep it sort of simple and say to your listeners that it's a way of studying yourself and learning about how you do what you do so that you can then gain skills and tools to improve your functioning and become more effective really in anything and everything that you wish and want to do.
So there was this guy, Frederick Alexander, back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, kind of, he was an Australian.
An actor or a wannabe actor.
Yes. Had a passion for acting. In those days, he was maybe not an actor the way we think of it. He was a Shakespearean orator.
Mm-hmm.
So he would travel around the country and with his small troupe and get up and recite monologues from Shakespeare. And he began losing his voice, and this was very distressing, and he went to the doctor, and he was told to drink honey and rest his voice. I mean, drink tea with honey and rest his voice. And his voice got better, and he went back to the performing and lost his voice again. So went back to the doctor. The doctor said, well, go back to drinking your tea and your honey. And Alexander said, why should I?
Right.
Which is an important question, I think, sometimes to ask professionals. In other words, he was saying, well, you know, when I rested my voice and didn't speak, it got better. But when I went back to speaking, I had the same problem. So this wasn't a solution. You know, mm-hmm. Resting, it helped. But it wasn't a solution to give me the skills to be able to use my voice effectively to do what I want to do.
Right.
And so that set him on a path. The doctor admitted he didn't really have much more to offer him at the time. And he began observing himself with mirrors and watching his profile as he spoke and uncovering some fascinating things about himself that he had no idea. He was speaking with tension in his muscles in his neck, and this was harming his voice.
Mm-hmm. And so from that, this whole body of knowledge was born. And fast forward to 30 years ago, how did you get introduced to it and really take it and run, starting this school in
yes.
New England, the author of a book? I know your book, it was 10 years in the making. What really prompted you into this whole study of the mind-body connection and interaction?
Well, I guess I'm a little bit like Alexander. I was a dancer in my youth, and I also rode horses, and these were two activities that I cared very passionately about, and I worked very hard and tried to get better. And then I began having more and more injury and pain, chronic back pain, waking up in the morning and hurting a lot. And I was by then a dance major in college, mm-hmm. and wondering why other people were dancing just as much as I was, but they were better. And why were other people rioting just as, you know, not even as much as I was, but they were better. And finally, I just happened to hear about the Alexander Technique through a friend and thought it sounded interesting, and I gave it a try. And within one or two lessons, I felt that this really was going to provide me with some ways to sort of unlock these mysteries about why I couldn't get my body to perform as I was trying to get it to perform, and why it was hurting so much. And I just fell in love with the lessons. They helped me with my pain, my back pain and my knee pain, which got better very quickly. And so after college, I went and studied to become a teacher, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
When you talk about using awareness of how you move for dancing, like your experience, or for being able to perform Shakespeare or sing like Alexander, like Frederick, it's an easy thing to grasp. But for the person that's just driving in the car right now, that's going to go and sit at the desk tomorrow for 8 hours, how does it apply to them, this
sure.
idea of becoming aware of where you're holding tension in your body, how you're holding your body, how
sure.
you're moving? Let's bring it home to them.
Well, you know, if you're driving for 2 hours and you get home and you have a headache and your neck is tight and your shoulders hurt, and typically people say, oh, you know, driving, it just makes me tense and, you know, I hate to drive, for example.
Right.
Well, the tension isn't just a function of the fact that you're driving. I mean, there really isn't anything so difficult about sitting in a car and steering the wheel and working the pedals. The problem is how we are coordinating ourselves unconsciously while we drive and reacting with too much tension and with a lot of mental stress and unnecessary effort. And it's possible to learn to change that. It's possible to learn to become more aware of the ways that you're using your body as you sit and drive with too much effort and how to stop doing that. So that's quite an art, you know. Usually people assume that if their body is giving them trouble, it means that they're weak and they should go do exercise.
Right.
But even people who exercise many hours a week or a day might find that driving a few hours makes them uncomfortable, or sitting at their desk all morning gives them backache. Or, you know, standing online at the bank makes their knees hurt. I don't know. You know, there are lots of examples where our difficulties and our physical complaints really are not being caused by weakness. They're being caused by overusing the wrong muscles and sort of mal-coordinating the whole of yourself as you do your activity. Does that help?
Yeah, you understand. Bring up a point in your book, how you stand, how you move, how you live, that if you look at a squirrel, for example, or right where I'm sitting here, I'm looking out a window, and oftentimes there's deer or elk. Within the animal kingdom, it's necessary for that animal, shortly after it's born, to be able to move, to run. It's instinctual. From the time they're born or very, very early, they're able to run and move. Whereas humans, we go through this whole process of just being entirely dependent on our mother or father, and then learning to start to move our body, and eventually shifting over onto our stomach, eventually crawling, then walking. And it's something that we learn. And I love the point that you make, is that we learn these things. We pick it up from somebody around us or who knows how we learn it. And then it becomes unconscious. It's a conscious process, and it becomes unconscious. Just like that analogy you hear all the time of driving a car first time. Oh, you're so stressed out. How much pressure do I put on the brake?
Exactly.
And then once you get the hang of it, you don't think about it anymore. So if we back up to those adolescent years, where do we start to maybe go wrong in that development or that learning how to move and walk, especially this day and age with the video games and the text messaging and in this electronic world that we live in?
Yeah. Well, you've covered a lot of ground there, Jason. you mentioned the adolescent years. I think we have to go a good deal further back.
Okay.
You know, one of the differences between the squirrel and ourselves is that we have a much larger brain. And one of the advantages of our larger brain is what the neuroscientists call neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
That is, with so many more neurons, we have a much greater capacity for learning. And there's an upside to that. I mean, we can learn to play, you know, the violin and, you know, to ski down a black diamond slope.
Right.
Squirrel doesn't learn to do these things. There's a downside. If you learn to do most of your activities, you're actually left to sort of learning usually by imitation and sort of trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, some of us learn to coordinate the mind and the body more efficiently and effectively than others of us. And the
that's what you call natural ability?
Yeah, yeah. There are definitely people who seem to, you know, from an early age, have sort of the underlying reflexes that govern how you coordinate yourself as the baby does.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem to lose it. If you watch infants learning to sit, if they're normal and healthy, they're all sitting up with this beautifully lengthening back and the head just sort of poised and balanced on top of the spine.
Right,
and the limbs
right, that
are
big
lengthening
old head.
And floating away from their bodies, and they make it look so easy.
Mm-hmm.
But as they get older, and now they're starting to have to layer on top of that learning, they're learning to sit in their desks at school, they're learning to hold their pens and write, they're learning to kick a ball on the playground. As more and more learned activity comes into their lives, there's more and more room for learning that goes awry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Alexander is unique in posing this wonderful question, well, how did I learn to do what I do? In his case, how did I learn to speak? And since I learned it inefficiently, I've learned to speak in a way that's causing a lot of extra tension in my neck and shoulders. Can I unlearn that? The
right.
question is really, at that point, first, not learning to do something else, but learning to stop doing the thing that's malcoordinating you. And that's really the hallmark of the Alexander technique, something that we call inhibition.
Mm-hmm.
How to stop doing what you shouldn't do, in a nutshell.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that paves the way to be able to, in a sense, relearn or learn anew. With those skills, you know, usually people have the notion that once they're adults, oh, I can't really change, you know. Oh, I'm always going to have a back problem. Oh, I'm always going to have a bad golf swing. Oh, I'll never be a really good skier. But often what they're not getting to as the crux of the problem is learning how to prevent what we call the misuse, the habits of malcoordination, before they go on to try to learn new ways of doing what they do.
Right. And you touched on that earlier. I think in our culture, we're a quick fix culture where you can open any, quote, health magazine and you're going to see 10 exercises to do today to you know, to sit all day at work upright or press here to release that. Whereas what I love about your book, How You Stand and How You Move, How You Live, is that you really raised the question, which can be a little overwhelming to look at, is like, how did you learn to stand? How did you learn to walk? Because those are things we take for granted. And the idea of going back and breaking that down, that can seem pretty, well, that can be overwhelming. Where do you start with somebody that's in their car right now that knows they're bound up? They just have this sense. Maybe it was a picture they got back from Christmas and they saw the family standing together and they're like, who's that? And then they're like, oh no, that's me. But they
You're painting a good picture. and, you know, typically with our habits of misuse, what we're doing is the muscles are getting tighter and shorter over time as we're aging.
Mm-hmm.
And over, you know, a few years, that's not such a big deal. But if you compound that over decades, you compare now how someone in their 70s sits and stands, and look at a young child sitting and standing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really observe closely, you see the child with this beautifully, as I described, upright, lengthening spine and a poised head, and they're balanced and they look so easy. And 90 years later, the spine's curved over, the head's pulled down and back on the neck, the shoulders are hunched, often the knees and the legs are squeezed in and tense, and moving is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a function of aging. That's a function of your accumulating misuse over many years. So how do we learn to change? Well, mm-hmm. Alexander said it doesn't take as many years to learn to undo it as it did that you've been maybe engaging in your misuse. But it is a learning process. It does take time. If you wanted to learn to master the piano, you wouldn't expect that you could learn to play a Beethoven sonata in a matter of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think your listeners need to think of the Alexander technique not as sort of a therapy and a quick fix, but really a course of study.
Right.
About themselves. And I try to say to my students, don't see this as a sign of your failure and get discouraged. See this as an opportunity to really marvel and enjoy this process of sort of uncovering aspects of yourself that you hadn't had any awareness of, and the joy of gaining skills to become more effective.
What I'd like to do as we go along in our interview is for you to take our listeners through some beginning exercises, self-exercises, mm-hmm. to get that awareness.
Sure.
But before we do that, if you're just joining us, we're talking today to Missy Vineyard. She's the author of the book, How You Stand, How You Move, How You Live. You can find this book online at Amazon.com. You can also visit her website, which is missyvineyard.com, and that's M-I-S-S-Y. VINEYARD.com. And once they get to that website, what are some of the things that they'll find there, Missy?
Well, there's information about the book and about the Alexander technique, about myself. One of the features in the book are some beautiful charcoal illustrations that are showing you the book is a lot of stories of my students in the process of their lessons and learning and changing, and so the illustrations are designed to show you how the body looks differently over as people study.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a site on the place on the website where people can link and purchase copies, reprints of these illustrations, which I think can be very helpful for other people who are in the professions that involve teaching people about their coordination and ease of movement.
Mm-hmm. And that's really a key. And that's mm-hmm. one of the things that you talk about right at the beginning of the book is it's not a book about how to stand as much as it is a book about how to move in life with more ease. And you use an example at the very beginning, classic poster that we've all seen of Michael Jordan in midair, just about ready to dunk the ball. Literally yeah. looks like he's flying.
Right.
He left
yeah.
about the free throw line. And you talk about Jordan and the ease at which he was able to do these activities. And then you go on and talk about other athletes. I think athletes are a good example because we're all familiar with their form because we see it. And
yeah.
One that you mentioned that comes to mind, who's been in the news a lot lately, is Tiger Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And Tiger really exemplifies to me what you're talking about with
his
self-study, because there's been points in his career where he was dominating. Just nobody could touch him. And then all of a sudden, he went back with an instructor and totally broke down his stroke, inhibited, and I want to get into what that means a little bit more, parts of it, and changed the way that he was hitting the ball so that he could hit another 15, 20 yards further. That kind of focus that Tiger Woods has to change his golf swing, when you apply it to the everyday person, where are they best fit to start, Missy? Is it with their seated posture? Is it with mm-hmm. how they stand? Is it with how they lay down at night? If with your 30 years of experience, where have you found is the best place for people to first become aware of what they're doing and what's going on in their body?
You've said it well, Jason. The place you start is with awareness. Back to Mr. Alexander looking at himself in the mirror, the shocking thing was that as he watched himself speaking, he saw that he was tensing his neck and pulling on its head in a peculiar way. But this was a complete astonishment because he hadn't felt that this was happening when he was speaking.
Mm.
He only discovered it for the first time when he looked in the mirror. So we make this assumption, you know, it's my body. Surely I'm the one who knows better than anyone about what I'm doing with my body, so
right.
to speak.
That's what, I mean,
but
in fact,
we're actually quite inaccurate.
Yeah, you just think of people that you see and you say, "Well, why are you limping?" And I'm
yeah,
not limping.
Exactly. They don't even know it.
Right.
You know. So back to sort of, you know, your earlier question about how we're different from squirrels. I mean, we have to learn how to move, but we also don't come with some sort of supra control inside the brain that says, oh, I know what these sensations from my body mean. I know what this is telling me. I know what's right, and now I'll correct it. We don't have a self-correcting mechanism. So if you break your leg and you're limping for months, that now becomes an unconscious locomotor pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You take the cast off, the leg is all better, but you might still be limping and not even know it.
Right.
Okay? So this is a psychophysical, what I like to call a psychophysical process. You can't just sort of now exercise a muscle. You've got a whole pattern of coordination that involves the mind and the body. And for Tiger to change his swing, he didn't just have to use his muscles differently. He had to learn to think differently about how he used his muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have a... there's not an easy quick fix in the sense of, well, I'll just mindlessly work a muscle with the barbells and all will be well. I've got to really examine how my mind is linked to my behavior. And we start with awareness. So I might simply have someone sitting in a chair and ask them to put their own hand at the back of their neck
mm-hmm.
and the head just lightly to sort of feel that part of their body. And I ask them to stand up from the chair and I say, what did you feel happening in your head and your neck with your hand as you stood up? And often to people's great surprise, they say, well, gee, gosh, you know, I'm feeling my muscles getting tight in the back of my neck and my head's kind of pulling on my neck.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, did you know you did that? And they say, no, I didn't know I did that. And the next challenge, I say, all right, well, you didn't know you did that. Now you know you did that. You do that. So can you stand up from the chair, leave your hand on your neck and feel what's happening? And can you stand up and not tense those muscles in the neck and the pulling on the head? And almost no one is able initially to not do that tension.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, they're learning in the lesson about the fact that if they just think the thought of doing something like standing up, it's the thought that's triggered to a whole pattern in the way they use their muscles.
I say that
and
again.
If they think of standing,
mm-hmm.
the thought connects to neurons that mm-hmm. connect with a particular group of muscles that's unique to you in the way that you move.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even have to begin to stand. You think of standing, and your brain is already activating your muscles in your particular way.
Mm-hmm. That's a big point.
That's a big thing.
I remember reading an article a few years back in Newsweek about Olympic athletes.
Yeah.
And they were spending as much time, it was with the javelin, the throw, visualizing it in a perfect throw, in a perfect
right.
form.
Right.
Because by doing that, they were firing off those muscles
exactly.
in the same sequence as if they were physically going out and doing that event.
Yeah. But here's the rub, though. If you conceive of throwing, if you mentally practice throwing your javelin or skiing down the slope, and you already throw the javelin or ski well, then your mental practice is extremely beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
If your way of throwing the javelin is faulty, when you imagine yourself throwing the javelin, you will actually be coordinating the muscles in your faulty pattern.
Mm-hmm. And then back to that neuroplasticity that you talked
yeah.
about, laying down more and more nerve connections that reinforce that faulty pattern.
That's right. So to change how you coordinate yourself from driving the car to sitting and standing in a chair to skiing down a slope,
mm-hmm.
we really have to look at the fact that the way that you're thinking about how you move is affecting how you move. And so now we're looking at the body as really a kind of a roadmap for getting inside the black box of how you use your mind.
Mm.
And the technique is really, in its depth, more about your mental skill than about your physical skill, because you're not changing what you do with your body if you don't change the way those neurons are firing.
Right. And this gets into that idea of inhibition that you talked about.
That's right, because now we're learning to use conscious thought in a way that can effectively help you to cause the neurons that are telling muscles to tense too much.
Mm-hmm.
You're not trying to control the muscles. You're trying to stop causing those neurons to fire.
Right. That's a big point. Because, I mean, again, like you mentioned earlier, we said so often people focus on strengthening a muscle.
Yeah.
Like that'll, but then on the other side of it, there's a whole school of thought that, oh, you're tight? Well, let me get in there and strip that muscle, or let me push that muscle, and we're going to release it. But I know through my experiences that, you know, people will have that done, and they'll feel relaxed for a day or two, and then boom, they're right back into old pattern because they're continuing to do the things, continuing to fire the same nerves that set it up in the first place.
That's right. I mean, there are lots of approaches out there that can make your muscles feel more relaxed and do feel good, and that's good. But you'll still move in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Your fundamental pattern of movement that's psychophysical, when you think of holding up, picking up your pen or picking up your musical instrument, it'll be the same whether you go work on massaging your muscles or you go work on the barbells.
Mm-hmm.
The pattern of coordination that underlies how you do your activity is the same. I work with a lot of students who are musicians, and all I have to do is sort of ask them to pick up their instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see what they're doing in their body and what they're already thinking about what they have learned to believe it takes to play their instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And until we can help them learn to shed that, teaching them new tricks in their technique is really only sort of moderately helpful.
It's kind of putting a layer on top of layer, but never ever releasing that fundamental faulty one.
That's right. That's a good way to say it.
One of the things that this brings up is we talked earlier about this fast-paced culture that we live in.
Mm.
And in your book, How You Stand, How You Move, How You Live, you do talk about the fight-or-flight response.
Yeah.
That's a old response in our bodies that served us well in being able to escape from dangers, a bear, a tiger, an enemy approaching, where we had to suddenly be in high alert, make a decision. Do I fight this threat? Do I cower away? Do I flight? Do I run away from it? But today, that same response that heightens us, that gets our heart beating faster, that has us breathe shallower, that tightens our muscles, that can get triggered by a traffic jam, by an impending downsizing at the company, by the fear of a recession really settling in. What's gas prices going to be when I go to the pump next? And so because of that, the thought of these things, those trigger in our bodies a whole sequence of tightening, just like a thought of getting out of a chair can. Is that accurate, Missy?
Absolutely. I try to draw in the book from the pioneering work of a neuroscientist at NYU named Joseph Ledoux, who wrote a wonderful book called The Emotional Brain. And his research focused on a part of the brain called the amygdala. And very simply, it seems from his work that any kind of stimulus coming to your brain via all your sensory systems, a loud noise, a pain in your knee, someone speaking to you in an angry voice, all your sensory inputs get sort of funneled eventually through the amygdala, and the amygdala seems to be the part of the brain that has the task of saying, could this be dangerous?
Mm-hmm.
And if your amygdala decides that a particular stimulus coming in might be threatening to you, it in an instant, it's changing your neurochemistry and your hormones and your muscle activity and triggering that sympathetic response that's causing you to be, in a sense, ready for defense, ready to protect. And the fascinating thing he speaks about to me is that in all vertebrates, we have sort of four stereotyped ways of behaving mm-hmm. when that amygdala is triggered. And he calls them, we freeze, like the deer in the headlights that becomes motionless. We withdraw, we run away. We might attack back, or we might submit. Don't usually think of submit as a defensive behavior, but it's a way, if let's say
like the possum.
Your boss could fire you, so he's asking you to do something you don't really want to do, but you say, well, okay.
Oh, yep.
Yeah. Well, the thing that Ledoux doesn't get into, and I think is often overlooked, is that all of these activities of, this flooding of hormonal and chemical changes in your body when your sympathetic system is activated, so that you withdraw, freeze, submit, or attack, all of that is playing across the landscape of your locomotor system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just making you have a queasy feeling in your stomach, it's making your muscles tense. and that's going to affect your behavior, your overall behavior and coordination as well. So I try to bring in how fear plays a big role in our coordination, and how to help students become aware of that mm-hmm. and work with that more constructively.
If a person is driving down the road,
yeah, right.
and they had a situation last Friday where on a certain stretch of road, somebody cut them off, and they darn near went into the ditch.
Right.
And they find themselves on Tuesday going down that same stretch of road. Traffic is as thick or thicker, and all of a sudden, they find themselves clenching the wheel a little tighter, breathing
That's
a little
right.
shallow. How does this concept of inhibition come into a situation like that?
Well, first we all understand that the amygdala learns. So you have that first episode where you have a near miss mm-hmm. in an accident, and then a week later, as you describe, you're going down the road and you're in the same place on the highway where that happened, and your amygdala is getting the information that, gosh, I'm in that same place, and links to memory. And there's nothing threatening in the present moment, but as your mind is summoning the memory of this previous experience, your amygdala starts sending you into a fear defense behavior without good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we need to understand that the mind itself acts like a stimulus on your whole organism to keep triggering you into sympathetic activity, to keep triggering you into defensive behavior. So
mm-hmm.
some of our tension in our muscles is because we've learned to move in ways that are sort of maladaptive. But a lot of our tension is also how we self-generate this sympathetic nervous system activity via the amygdala. And our experience as we go through life kind of keeps building more and more behaviors that your amygdala learns to think of as threatening. And we're constantly stimulating ourselves into fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of tragic.
And it's escalating.
It's
encouraged in our culture, too.
Yeah.
Fear of this disease, fear of this war, fear of
That's
gas.
Right.
I mean, it's red alert. And, we're surrounded by that message.
Yeah, it's sort of ironic that we have this fabulous technology we're surrounded by that's designed to make our lives easier and more comfortable. And yet we're also sort of in this trap where the mind has the power to propel us into fear, even though, we don't live around tigers and bears anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're our own worst enemies now, in a sense, because we don't have a conscious understanding of this process. And we're, back to your question, where does inhibition come in? What's fascinating, once your amygdala decides that something's a threat, and is activating your sympathetic system, you can't control that. But you can become aware, more back to our idea of awareness, you can become more aware of the feelings in your body that let you know that this is happening to you. And with more awareness, you now have the opportunity to bring, again, this conscious inhibition skill into play and say to yourself, oh, okay, I know why I'm gripping the wheel right now. I'm in the same place I was in last week when I nearly, you know, had that accident. I don't have to keep reacting this way.
Right.
You have the ability to bring consciousness to play to turn it off. But I don't think there's enough public awareness of that capability that we all have.
Right, to be self-aware. Just like with Tiger Woods with the golf swing, if the ball starts hooking, he's self-aware enough to say, oh, I need to adjust this,
That's right. I call it self-correcting. We can more accurately perceive what's happening and then more accurately choose the appropriate response as opposed to just be sort of locked into a reaction and an unconscious habit.
If you're just joining us today, we're talking to Missy Vineyard. She's the author of the book, How You Stand, How You Move, How You Live. You can find it online at Amazon.com. You can also visit her website, which is MissyVineyard.com. Now, you know, so far, Missy, we've talked about becoming aware, aware of when our body gets triggered into these fear mechanisms, that fight or flight are one of those four responses that you talked about. We've talked about how early on we may have developed patterns of walking, of sitting, of moving that seem to be fine for our first 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but there's little hitches in how we're doing things that over the years start to build up that can lead to problems like arthritis or muscle aches or kind of deformed posture down the road. So once a person becomes aware, and we talked about ways of doing that. You mentioned literally putting your hand on your body, like the back of your neck, and feeling. Does that become tense? Or looking in a mirror, as Frederick Alexander originally did, to see when he began to speak and sing and how his throat was moving and how his head was responding, or looking at a photograph that was taken at a family reunion and getting a sense for how we're carrying ourselves. These are all kind of awareness tools. What's the next step when a person says, all right, Missy, I know, I do. I do feel like I have the weight of my world on my shoulders. I start out the day, I don't feel that way, but I go to work and I'm at the computer and I can just feel it building, but I don't know what to do about it.
Right. Well, here is where we come to the Alexander technique and the skill of the teacher. Alexander teachers go through a very lengthy training in the way that they use their hands to instruct the student. In other words, I might have a student lying on their back on a table, and I might simply say to them, I'm going to bend your leg, and I don't want you to do anything. And the moment I begin to bend their leg, the student reacts with their habitual pattern of tension, and the muscles clench, and they pull on their leg, and they kind of grab it away from me, and they're, while they do that, they're tensing in their neck or their belly or their back or all, holding their breath. And we stop, and we say, ah, did you notice what happened just then? Mm. Oh, yeah, gee, maybe I gripped some more muscles than I need to. Okay, let's try this again. My hands are going to guide and lift the leg. You are going to practice thinking in the moment as the situation is happening, as you're being fed the stimuli from your own body of feeling me moving your leg. You're going to practice keeping the conscious awareness and thought, I don't have to lift my leg. In this sort of simple way, the student is having the opportunity to experience parts of their body being moved, which sort of trigger them into their habit, and in the face of that, practicing the mental skill of continuing to think of not doing that reaction. And they gradually learn to think in a more effective manner to, as we were saying earlier, tell those neurons not to fire, so those muscles don't get activated unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm.
When you can practice that in that sort of simple arena, if you will, in concert with the student, I mean the teacher, and the teacher's feedback and the way the teacher's hands guide you as you move from lying down, bending a leg, to how you stand and sit, to how you squat, to how you reach for something on the shelf, this is giving you sort of in-the-moment practice. It's not theory. You know, we're here talking about it together, but to change these patterns of activity, what's really best is when you have a skilled teacher to sort of be guiding and working with you and giving you feedback in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help give a little picture?
So it's literally about learning new patterns of movement, but at the same time, kind of rebooting the system. Is that a way of saying it?
Yeah, you know, your mind and your body are an interactive system. So every time you move, you cause sensations to be triggered about in your body from the movement, which your brain is registering.
Mm-hmm.
So when the teacher comes along and just moves the student's leg or an arm or turns their head, in a split second, the student's brain is feeling that
mm-hmm.
and judging those feelings. And judging what those feelings mean, and turning around and sort of imposing its own reaction. So we're helping take the student very kind of micro inch by micro inch through these moments in time when that reaction is kicked off, so they can practice choosing a different response,
mm-hmm.
and therefore changing this pattern of inefficiency or misuse. And the fascinating thing is that I like to say to students, your body is not a refrigerator. And what I mean by that is if a refrigerator is broken, of course, you've got to figure out the part that's not working and take that out and get a new part and put it in. You've got to know what's wrong and you've got to know the right thing to fix it. With a living organism, you have mechanisms in yourself that are designed to enable you to sit and move well
mm-hmm.
and skillfully. And our task is to sort of learn how to stop getting in the way.
Yeah.
If you can inhibit and get out of the way more and more effectively, then the reflexes that help put the right amount of tonus in the muscles at the right moment and to the right degree, they tend to just turn on.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be restored. So the Alexander student starts looking a little bit more like that young child who's sitting up so beautifully with balance and ease, just because they've kind of removed the impediment.
Right.
But it's really, I have to say, I mean, Alexander did figure this out by himself. So, you know, the book sort of tells the reader about that process of discovery and gives them some what I call self-experiments to retrace that learning process.
Yes.
For themselves. So someone who's really motivated, I think you could read those self-experiments and do a lot.
Yeah.
But I also want to make a plug for a good Alexander teacher can help that process along.
It's kind of irony is that we learn things at an early age that then become subconscious,
right.
But when we continue to do those, and they may serve us very well or they may not serve us at all.
Yeah.
And then there's the flip side of it is we become aware that, boy, I really need to change the way that I'm walking because of what it's doing to my left hip.
Right.
And then in the process of becoming aware, so we overthink things
too. We over-control.
Yeah. What I think about is one of the sports I love to play is tennis. And
uh-huh.
this time of year here in Colorado, snow is just melting. Courts are getting dry. And that first time out, I feel like an all-star because I'm not expecting anything of myself.
You just
kind of let your body go. It falls in its natural rhythm. Then after you start hitting a few good shots, you think, oh, I really got it. And then I start expecting myself to hit those shots and start analyzing it. And then it all goes out the window. And you share the story in your book, How You Stand, How You Move, How You Live, about your son and going out and hitting a baseball. Mm-hmm. Would you share that with our listeners?
Oh, sure. It's one of my favorites. My young son was in Little League and came home one day crying in frustration from practice because he struck out at bat. And I said, you know, gee, let's go to the field tomorrow. Maybe I can help you with your batting. And he was, of course, typically disdainful that his mother could be of any use to him. But he didn't have any better options, so he agreed to give me a try. And we were out on the field the next day, and I'm not a great pitcher or anything, but I could, you know, throw him the ball and watch that as the ball is traveling towards him, what is he doing? He's tensing in his legs. He's gripping the bat with his hands ferociously. He's pulling his shoulders in. He's pulling his head back. By the time the ball gets over the plate, he gives it a mighty swing and misses it completely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much what you're describing, because the ball is the stimulus, and he sees that ball coming at him. And what's he thinking about? Well, now he's thinking, I got to hit a home run.
Right.
I got to hit this ball hard. You know, I got to give this a mighty swing. And by the time the ball gets there, he has so much tension that the last thing he can do is swing well.
Right, right.
And you sort of described that well. When you first come out to play tennis after you haven't done it in a while, often you do better.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. If you haven't practiced in a while, you have less expectations. Once you play well, now you have a memory of that, and you start thinking, "Oh God, I got to hit this shot like the last one."
Right, right.
And you're responding differently. Just by having that thought, I got to hit this shot like the last one, that's a different moment
mm-hmm.
than the one when you first came out and didn't have that thought. So I said to Jared, well, Jared, you know, you're not keeping your eyes on the ball. This is sort of classic, right? The batter's got to keep their eyes on the ball. And he insisted to me very defiantly, well, I am seeing the ball. I said, no, you're not seeing the ball. And, yes, I am. So I was racking my brain how to get across to my fine young son that he wasn't seeing the ball. And I said to him, all right, we're going to try something here. And what I want you to do is stand at the plate and hold the bat. And I'm going to throw the ball, but I don't want you to swing. All I want you to do is watch that ball traveling towards you and see it in front of you and then see it traveling, you know, past the plate. So he agreed to give this a try, and I'm throwing the ball, and I say, okay, Jared, did you see that ball? Did you see it the whole time that it was moving towards you? And he goes, oh, I'm not so sure, Mom. I throw the ball a few more times. Oh, gee, now I'm noticing, Mom, you know, that it's weird because I see that ball when you start to throw it, and then when it gets about 4 feet in front of me, I stop seeing it.
Mm.
Well, now we have some awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Aha, Jared. This is what I'm saying. This is what I mean when I say to you, you're not seeing the ball. Your eyes are open. You want to see the ball. But as that ball gets closer to you, now you're thinking about swinging.
Right.
And as soon as your mind, in the subtlest way, shifts to the idea that you got to think about swinging and how you're holding your bat, you actually malcoordinate the very delicate little muscles around the eyeball so that you're not focusing as well.
Mm.
So we just spent, you know, 15 minutes practicing watching the ball so that he could get to the place where he could actually really recognize whether or not he was seeing the ball traveling through space the whole time, that it approached him and was in front of him and went beyond him.
Mm-hmm.
Next step, I said, all right, Jared, now this time I'm going to throw the ball. You're going to keep seeing it. You may move your bat, but I don't want you to do a full swing. I'd like you to just move the bat so that the ball and the bat are going to meet out there in front of you, and if you're really watching the ball, you're going to see the moment that the ball touches the bat and then stop moving your bat.
Hmm.
He was very skeptical.
And
the moment that I gave him permission on that next throw to swing his bat, he was right back to all the old tension.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, and he missed the ball. I said, well, Jared, what were you thinking? He said, well, I was thinking about hitting a home run. And I said, well, what weren't you thinking? Oh, I wasn't thinking about seeing the ball. Okay, so now our task isn't for you to think about your bat. Our task is for you to move the bat while you keep thinking about seeing the ball. And to make a long story short, gradually with practice, just in one session, he became able to recognize when he was keeping his mind on the task of seeing the ball. The fascinating thing that does is send those visual inputs into a part of the brain, and your brain's kind of like a mini computer calculus machine figuring out the rate of speed of the ball and its direction, and it turns around and activates your muscles and moves your bat just at the right moment, and bam, there you are with your bat touching the ball right in front of you.
Right.
And the third step was just to let him follow through with his swing. And as the rest of the season, he had phenomenal batting success.
Right. And that's just a great example of this inhibition. Just to literally saying to himself, I'm not hitting the ball. So
right.
He got all that stuff that he was trying to do, trying
yeah.
to make happen out of the way.
Yeah.
So the person that's going in for a job interview.
Right. There's another good example.
Yeah. Like what could they say to themselves so that they don't start sweating profusely and cower up? I mean,
right. Well, you know, it sounds sort of silly. I can give the example of, you know, getting ready to speak to you today for this interview
mm-hmm.
and feeling myself getting nervous. And I actually, the readers, your listeners are going to find this hard to believe, but I sat down and I said to myself, I'm not giving an interview today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I repeated that thought to myself for about 10 minutes. And after about 10 minutes, not instantly, but after about 10 minutes of simply quietly renewing the thought to myself, I'm not giving an interview, my heart slowed down. My voice came back. My mind cleared. My tension sort of drained away. It wasn't totally gone. I had a little bit of nervousness, but not so much that I couldn't talk with you today.
Right.
And I think a job interview is a similar thing. And it sounds silly, you know, people, when you first give people this idea, they think, well, that's ridiculous. Why am I going to sit there and tell myself I'm not having a job interview today? Of course I'm having a job interview today. But if you try it, you'd be surprised, because if you're getting ready for something, you're subliminally constantly saying to yourself, oh my God, this thing is coming up. Oh my God, I've got this interview. Oh my God, I might blow it. Oh Jesus, what if I blow it and I don't get this job and I feel like a fool? You know, you don't realize it, but all those thoughts are feeding your amygdala.
Right.
And that's feeding your sympathetic system, and that's getting your muscles all tense and affecting everything from your breathing to your belly to your throat and how you speak. If you can say to yourself, all right, I'm not going to keep feeding myself that message. I'm not having this interview. Things can calm down in a remarkable way.
See, I love that. And as you're saying, your book really does go through and give people self-experiments that they can mm-hmm. do to begin to get a feeling or experience of this. And that's a big thing that you talk about, this idea of inhibition. Like the person driving the car and they get to that same part of the road, they could literally say, I'm not driving the car right now.
Yeah.
I'm not driving the car right now. Or
yeah.
the golfer that has the yips where they go to putt, and instead of making a 1 foot putt, they end up hitting it 12 feet past the hole. They could, I'm not putting right now.
That's right.
And so that's,
or, you know, you have to kind of listen to the voices in your head. Maybe there's a voice in your head saying, you know, I have to make this putt. What if you said to yourself, I don't have to make this putt?
Hmm.
You know, anything that kind of can kind of turn around the tape in your head and sort of reset for a new agenda.
Is that something that you, even after 30 years, I guess you talked about the radio interview, that you continually have to do? Or does a person like Michael Jordan, who we used about
yeah.
earlier as an example of self-mastery, and you talk about that concept in your book, how you stand, how you move, how you live, is do you get to a point where you're just being it rather than having to do these mental tricks, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a mental trick. I think it's real.
Real, okay.
You're not tricking yourself. You're actually changing neurological activity. So that's real.
Right.
Okay. Do you guess that you never have to do that? No. I mean, I'm sure I don't want to speak for Michael Jordan, but
right.
In some of the interviews I've seen of him, in some of the videos I've watched, you know, he speaks very eloquently about, I forget his name, Phil Jackson, the coach on the Bulls,
right.
and how the coach
Zen-like.
Was giving them a certain kind of training in Buddhism, really,
right.
which has a certain overlap with some of Alexander's ideas. You know, the mental aspect of play was every bit as important as the physical aspect. And how he did have to learn to use his mind every bit as skillfully as he had to learn to use his body.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've heard him say that there was not a shot on the court that he got into during a game that he hadn't visualized 500
right.
times before outside
right.
the court.
you know, there's certainly an element where with practice, it gets easier. Inhibition, you know, and your motor coordination when you use inhibition gets more and more skillful. And there will be times when it feels like you don't have to kind of give it the conscious boost because it's all working well. The inhibition is for the moments when it's failing you.
Right, right.
And gives you a way back in.
And you did, that's a great point you brought up. It's not a mental trick. It's very much a technique that has a whole body effect.
Yeah.
When you do that. What about the opposite side of that? Instead of inhibiting, about directing the body to do something.
Yeah. Well, we haven't really had time today. The second sort of major skill in the Alexander technique, one is the inhibition. The second is something we call directing, which I try to explain in the book as the skill of the mind to think spatially.
Mm-hmm.
And I have ways in there readers can practice what I mean by that, that your brain literally has the sensory apparatus in your inner ear, your vestibular apparatus, for being able to think of three dimensions in space. And great athletes are almost always very, very skilled spatial thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
So that plays a part, too, like Jared with the bat, seeing the ball and how that links into parts of the brain that help adjust the muscle activity and coordinate you. And I would say people like Jordan who have to aim for the basket. Some people don't like the use of that word, but it depends on what you mean by it. But, you know, you don't shoot for the basket with your eyes closed. You do have a way of having a quality in your mind of knowing spatially where it is.
Right, right.
And the more you practice at that and link that to the visual system, the better the odds are you're going to get the ball in the basket.
Right. And I would encourage, if you're listening to this interview right now, to pick up a copy of Missy's book, because she goes through each section has different exercises, both with inhibition and then in this idea of direction and understanding what that means to start to get a feel in your own body of spatial awareness, and then relating what you feel inside your body to the world around you and how you move and interact in your day-to-day activities. What final thought would you like to leave with our listeners today, Missy?
Well, I would like to share the absolute thrill and excitement and joy that comes from this process of learning more about yourself and gaining the skills to understand your own internal mental physical workings in a way that you find increasing success in whatever you wish to do. That's not a burden. That's something that's so liberating and joyful and really makes you young at heart all your days. I work with a lot of people who are a great deal older, and often for the elderly, you know, moving, the simple task of moving the body has become more and more challenging, more and more difficult. And the quality of life, even though they may be healthy, is very compromised if standing up from the chair is painful and difficult, if walking down the hall can't be done without a walker. So at any age, there's joy to be gained from an improving skill and mastery in the use of yourself.
Hmm. Thanks, Missy. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Jason.
Again, you've been listening today to Missy Vineyard. She's the author of the book, How You Stand, How You Move, How You Live. You can find it online at Amazon.com. You can also visit her website, which is just her name.com, and I'll spell that for you. It's MissyVineyard.com. Thank you for stopping by today. I'm Jason Steinle, and I hope you enjoyed today's program. You can find additional shows by visiting www.uploadexperience.com/blog. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our newsletter. You'll receive information to help make your life easier, as well as be notified as new shows are released. You can also find us at iTunes. Search Upload Experience under podcast. And if you enjoyed today's show, be sure to leave us a comment there as well. Thanks for stopping by. We'll talk to you soon. Goodbye for now.